This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with John Gibson with IU Northwest School of Business and Economics. The weekend MBA program is getting underway early next year in Michigan City, and we'll find out more about it and how to sign up for it. We also have a conversation as well from Sharon Jackson about tomorrow's On the Table conversations being held by the Legacy Foundation, which is Lake County's community foundation, happening all across Lake County, and why it's so important to be part of it. And a conversation as well with Purdue University Northwest Vice Chancellor of Enrollment Management and Student Affairs, Carmen Panlilio. Purdue Northwest has set a record for student retention, a good record for regional campuses across Northwest Indiana. Indiana University Northwest's College of Business and Economics is offering residents who live in Eastern Porter and LaPorte County communities the chance beginning in January to earn an MBA by taking weekend classes. Here's John Gibson, the Director of Graduate and Undergraduate Programs for the college on the Gary campus, with some background information about the program.
We've been doing this program actually for 11 years on the main campus here in Gary, and it's a weekend MBA that meets every other Saturday from, say, 8 to about 3 in the afternoon. And we're expanding it out to the Michigan City area. We're going to be offering it at the Northern Indiana Education Foundation offices on 4th and Franklin in Michigan City. And it's been a real success, I would say, in terms of from the student perspective, because it's a cohort program. So every student, you know, starts and finishes together, and they get done in 18 months, and they actually form quite a bond over that 18 months.
I would imagine. Now, what difference is there any from the campus, the Gary campus program, compared to this one that's offered on weekends on the Michigan City campus?
There is absolutely no difference, which is what's great about it. Same faculty, same courses, same structure. We're just offering at an off-campus location, and we feel very strongly about Michigan City and about the Porter County area. It's part of our mission here at Northwest is not just to serve Lake County and Porter County, but really the seven county district or area here in Northwest Indiana, which includes Stark, LaPorte, and Newton County, and so we feel that. You know, it's a great opportunity for folks in the Michigan City area and even Southwest Michigan to get an IU degree close to home.
I was wondering if you have many opportunities for students that live out of state, but they're too far away to come to Gary for regular classes, but they come to Michigan City because they are close enough they can take advantage of this particular program.
Absolutely. We did a little research and saw that it's about 40,000 people in Berrien County, Michigan, who have an undergraduate degree, but there's really, it's kind of like a desert, if you will, for higher ed in that part of Michigan. The closest would be Kalamazoo and Western Michigan University, but, you know, the majority of folks live within 30 minutes of Michigan City. So we're definitely reaching out to that area, but we're obviously our key focus is serving folks here in Indiana, and in particular in LaPorte County, giving them another option and a weekend option. It's something that even our South Bend campus doesn't offer a weekend MBA. So we're reaching out to those folks too.
That's great. Now, John Gibson, tell us, for folks who are not necessarily familiar, they've heard, of course, about a business MBA, but tell us what a business MBA involves, the type of courses that you take to be able to get your work in within a year and a half, or for some maybe, if they come to campus, main campus a little longer, perhaps, just to be able to get that master's degree in business administration.
You know, it's interesting that the MBA was actually started in the 50s by Harvard and a couple other Ivy League schools, and it was designed actually for the non-business major. Mm-hmm. So folks who had degree backgrounds in sciences or engineering to come and get the business training. And so it was originally designed for that kind of student, and it's what I like to call kind of a general business degree, and that in this case is a good thing, because it covers all the functional areas of business. So we have finance and accounting, marketing, human resources, the operations management, information systems, and it puts it together at the decision-making level. In the 80s, it kind of became, the degree itself kind of became a like a must-have for any business major. And so, you know, we get a little of both in terms of the students that we get. I'd say half are kind of that, you know, business major or some kind of business background. And then the other half are, you name it, everything, any kind of major you can think of. We've had nurses and radiologists. We've had medical doctors. We've had people with sociology degrees. And I've even had high school teachers do the program. So it's a unique thing in that it covers everything, and it gives you a really broad, you know, spectrum in terms of job opportunity. You can do basically a little bit of everything.
Now, when you and the dean of the school, Cynthia Roberts, get together and talk about these programs like this, the weekend MBA program, it's once again starting up there in Michigan City, do you think this is an opportunity, and especially as you've seen over the years how many students in different disciplines decided to go on for an MBA degree, that we're finding that this is a way that we can maybe expand our educational outlook as well to plan for the jobs of the future? They're not all high-tech jobs, but they are specialized jobs in many cases, and probably that business degree probably helps them get established in new careers, I would imagine.
Absolutely. That's definitely what we're seeing, and in particular in the healthcare field. Healthcare is, you know, obviously a big issue at the national level, state level, here locally. But I also think that folks who get into the medical field, and like I said, broad spectrum from nursing and doctors, radiologists, but there's also a huge administrative side to healthcare, and I think both the nonprofits and the for-profit healthcare sectors are looking for people who have that business background, have that business mindset, along with the really solid, you know, medical health background that they have, and that's kind of what we're seeing. And Michigan City obviously has Franciscan out there. IU Health is out there. So we think there's a huge need there, and also we're very committed to seeing Indiana thrive, and we think that this is a great first start in terms of sharing with folks in LaPorte County the fact that they can get a Master's of Business Administration degree from IU and really apply that into their lives and better their communities.
Now, John, let's get some nuts and bolts information here. Tell us, and we can pass along the information to people who are interested in signing up for this weekend MBA program series that is getting underway in Michigan City, where they can find out more information, they can find out what the classes are like, and, of course, get enrolled for that as well, too, and when the classes are going to begin.
We're planning on launching this in January, so it'll be a spring start. And anybody can just go to iun.edu/MBA and find all the information there.
That's great. And so obviously the sooner that you sign up, if you're interested, do so now, because the sooner you get signed up, the better likelihood that you'll have a chance to get in on these initial classes in January.
Absolutely. I already have one student admitted and several in the pipeline. So and obviously folks can reach out to me as well, and my information's at iun.edu/MBA if they'd like to have a conversation or have a meeting. And we'll be having some open houses out in Michigan City over the next couple of months as well.
That's great. Look forward to those as well, too. We've been talking with John Gibson, who is the director of graduate and undergraduate programs with the School of Business and Economics at IU Northwest, the Gary campus. The Gary campus is expanding out its MBA program outside Gary to cover people in Northwest Indiana interested in getting an MBA degree. The classes are going to be getting underway in January in Michigan City, and check the website out and find out more if you're interested in enrolling and working on getting your MBA in a very reasonable period of time as well, too. John, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it. We look forward to it, and we'll be back in touch soon, I'm sure.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Nearly 2,000 people are expected to gather at various meetings tomorrow, Tuesday, September 26th, to discuss ways to create a better future for Lake County. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson talked with Erica Fizer, the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Legacy Foundation, Lake County's community foundation, about the event, its purpose, and goal.
Legacy Foundation was selected as one of 10 community foundations across the country to replicate this On the Table initiative, which was originally started by the Chicago Community Trust a few years ago. So the goal of it is to get people in their own spaces, in small group conversations, talking about the future of their community, however they might define that, whether that's neighborhood or their block or Lake County as a whole. So we are working with the University of Illinois Chicago, the Institute for Policy and Civic Engagement, to develop a survey that everyone who participates in these conversations will be asked to fill out, and the feedback from those conversations will be used to help guide Legacy's future funding strategy and our goals going forward, but we'll also share all of the outcomes report publicly so that other groups can also use feedback from these conversations to help guide the work that they're already doing.
How does Legacy do? Do they implement like community projects or kind of help define goals and make a plan or what?
Sure. So Legacy Foundation is the community foundation serving Lake County. We work with donors to connect them to nonprofit organizations who need resources. We work with nonprofits to help support their services with grant funding and professional development. And we work with scholarship recipients, so local Lake County High School and current college students. So that's the main focus and mission of Legacy Foundation. Specific to On the Table, we've been working with all of these groups to help organize and provide them resources to host a conversation on September 26th. And that includes prompts to help them get the conversation going, and a discussion guide that kind of gives an overview of why we think coming together and breaking bread with one another is important and an important first step in moving community forward. And so we're really acting for On the Table as a resource just to help organize and provide resources for On the Table conversations.
What conversations do you expect will be had? Like, what would be the topics? Would it be maybe like how we can get along better or a certain kind of service that you want set up in your community or something?
So we're not guiding the topic of a conversation. We're really leaving it pretty open-ended. If the group themselves want to focus on a specific issue area, they're welcome to do that, but Legacy Foundation isn't guiding that. So the conversation prompts that we provide are really pretty broad. They ask questions like, what positive characteristics does our community have? How can we take steps to leverage the assets in our community? How can we work together to improve the chances of more people doing well? How do you define doing well? And so really it's just to get people talking and thinking not just about the problems that their community may have or the issues and challenges, but next steps to kind of move things forward and get positive work happening.
And what do you think will be materialized out of this event?
Legacy is providing immediately after we're opening up these community action awards, and we'll be providing 10 $1,000 grants for actionable ideas that come out of these conversations. So that's really, it's not a lot of money, but I think $1,000 can help jumpstart a project and can really empower a neighborhood group to do something. And so in the long term, the feedback that we get from all of these and why it's important that we hear from so many people around the county is that it will help better inform our funding strategy. So when we're making grants out into the community, that we are being responsive to the needs that we hear coming up in these conversations. There are over 30 public sites that people who wanted to host and wanted to open up their table for people to join who may not be connected to a formal organization, those are up on our website at legacyfdn.org/onthetable. And so anyone who wants to participate and doesn't know where to go or how to get involved in a conversation, they can join any of those tables that are listed. And we have conversation taking place in all areas of Lake County, in all cities and towns. I'm hoping that people will sign up and join and make their voices heard.
What is that website again?
It is legacyfdn.org/onthetable.
That's Erica Fizer, who's the Director of Marketing and Communications for the Legacy Foundation, talking about tomorrow's On the Table conversations all across Lake County. Purdue University Northwest has picked up a record already, and the semester just started, in setting records, we should say, in retention rates as well as in the full-time student populations. And to find out more on the Hammond campus, we're going to talk with Purdue University Northwest Vice Chancellor for Enrollment Management and Student Affairs, Carmen Panlilio. Dr. Panlilio, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. My pleasure.
This is great news to hear from the Hammond and the Westville campuses, and I think probably, I'm sure, has probably made the people at the other Purdue University campuses think about how their enrollment figures are. They probably are looking back as well, too, as the new semester starts. If you will, take some time, tell us how the records seem to show well for the Purdue University Northwest this year.
Well, one of the things we're absolutely proud of is student retention. And when we talk student retention, we're talking about the freshmen from last year coming back to be sophomores this year. And I think you already know it went up almost 8% in the one-year time span. And people keep on asking us why or how this happened.
And what the, and to say that we noticed that it was, it's 68.2%, which is up 7.5% from last year, according to the information. And I understand here it's turned out it's the highest ever for the university. This is, and we're going back a number of years, even back to the years when Purdue Northwest was just basically known as Purdue Calumet and Purdue Westville, and they were pretty much, commuter campuses.
Yes, they were. But one of the things that we actually do want to emphasize is the fact that it's Purdue Northwest now, and the fact that we're looking at numbers that represent both locations, both campuses. So it's not just the Purdue Calumet or the Purdue Westville. So the 68%, especially because it was 60-something percent last year, is something we're really proud of. And I really think it speaks to the quality of our students. More than anything else. There is now a uniform admission standard for both locations. So we have really excellent students coming in. Their average GPA is 3.24, I believe, and that's another record right there. But Chris, if I may, one of the things that we're also really proud of is what we've been doing on campus in terms of helping the students actually come back. And this is where I think the real reason for retention being so good comes in. It's the support and the engagement that the students feel when they do come to be part of PNW. For example, we had year-long new student orientation, so to speak. It was a year-long orientation. It wasn't just the orientation that students go to before classes start. This time around, we had so many events going on in the fall semester as well as in the spring semester, so that as the students were finding their feet, so to speak, on campus and meeting all of these new friends and seeing all of the requirements for college, and again, this is all very new to them, they were getting the help they needed. There were the student ambassadors were there, the new student orientation leaders were there, but other student support service offices were there as well. Our Disability Access Center, for example, was front and center so that the students who might need some type of help in terms of transitioning and or continuing with any of the accommodations they may have had when they were in K through 12 would find it and not flounder and be lost. Our Counseling Center, our Career Center, and then, of course, we can never, ever, ever discount the engagement of just being part of or watching the different sports teams on campuses, on both locations as well. So these are all the little things, the engagement and the support that the whole campus has been working on. And this is in addition to tutoring and supplemental instruction. So it's both academic and social. I think that's the real best combination as far as improving retention.
I suppose that even as well, although it's not to as great an extent, because it's not a big percentage of the student population, but residential life has something to do with the two, having the opportunity, if a student chooses, to be able to live on campus.
Oh, thank you for reminding me of that, Chris. And shame on me for not saying it, but you're absolutely right. Even if it's a small percentage, housing, university housing and residential education, that's a huge deal. And in fact, one of the other things that we're proud of is this is the highest in terms of occupancy we've had for our university housing. In fact, towards the end of this summer, we had this amazing problem of having more than 100% in terms of applicants to stay in our dorms. And I hope Scott Iverson, our executive director of housing, forgives me for using the word dorms, but I'm old-fashioned enough to refer to them that way.
I know. I catch myself doing that too. You know, and I've been drilled enough over the years from the folks down at the Purdue University main campus in West Lafayette says never call them dorms. They're residence halls.
Yes, but then again, residence halls, dorms,
right.
Whatever else they might be, they do provide another anchor on campus. And right now we're at the highest in terms of occupancy. And like I said, before the semester started, we had 101 applications. So that was a wonderful problem to have, trying to figure out who we could accommodate. And they do add to the college experience, the college life.
One of the things I'd like, if you would, to mention, too, and the information that came out from campus about these great figures is the full-time freshman population this year, as we start another school year, it's up a bit, and there's some other good stats as well, too, on the on-campus undergraduate student body.
Yes. This is the fourth time in a row that our incoming freshmen, that over 95% are actually full-time, and the percentage of our students who are traditional age is also consistently, again, amazingly high. In fact, it's been so high that over the years, we've moved the needle to having a total percentage of our students being traditional age. Mm-hmm. So this idea of Purdue Northwest, formerly Calumet or Westville, being for non-traditional students, for students who plan to start and then stop, that kind of thing. That's an old idea of who we are at this point. Now they're traditional age, younger, more intent on finishing in 4 years.
It's interesting to note that because it does show how the campuses have morphed and made the change, the transition over the years from this commuter campus being strictly ones for people, adults maybe looking for a better education or in other jobs and wishing to expand their horizons and going to college. And maybe in many cases, it's the first member of a family that's ever been to college. But we've gone to this change here where we have young people coming out of high school or other schooling, and they're going into Purdue University Northwest classes as young people as well. It's interesting to see how this happens. Carmen, are there any other benchmarks that we can expect, as since we've got the semester just underway now, that we can look forward to?
Well, we're happy that our retention is so high, but of course we're not happy enough to just rest on our laurels. We still want to work on that. But also in terms of our graduation and our completion rates, that's the other thing that we really are working on. And one of the best ways of doing that is to make sure that our students are taking more than the usual 12 credits per semester. College is 120 credits total to get a bachelor's degree. And if you do that in 4 years and do the math, you can't do it at 12 credits per semester. You have to be doing at least 15 for a total of 30 per year. So these are the things we're trying to persuade our students to think about naturally. And that's where a lot of the support services we're putting into place or have actually put into place are really seeing some progress.
We've been talking with Carmen Panlilio, who is the Vice Chancellor for Enrollment Management and Student Affairs at Purdue University Northwest. She works out at the Hammond campus and has a staff as well at Hammond as the Westville campus as well. Purdue Northwest has set some university records for student retention, and we're great to hear this information. And thanks for being with us to talk about it, Carmen. About 2.5 years ago, it was just an idea in the mind of Chicago entrepreneur Theaster Gates, a single building in the city of Gary that is a kitchen, a classroom, a cultural center, and an art gallery. Today, Art House, a social kitchen, is a very busy venue to which artists and Northwest Indiana residents can turn to for progressive opportunities to collaborate. The director of Art House, Arlene Peterson, was with us here on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk about this remarkable project that was made possible in part by the City of Gary's very first City's Challenge Grant from the John S. and the James L. Knight Foundation.
I think some of the great vision that Theaster brought to the table, also the synergy and energy of Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, those two individuals coming together and really thinking differently about what can we do to help reignite and make Gary a place where folks want to continue to come, where businesses can begin to thrive, and you start to bring a bit of the local flavor and local feel for what's going to happen in the community. And the opportunities of the Night City Challenges came about, which was really about how can we create an incubator type program that's going to support economic development in the city. Along with that was the Bloomberg Philanthropies Public Art Challenge, was how can we, you know, infuse money into a community and help them do something that they probably wouldn't think to maybe pay for or have the money or funding to do something different, which the Public Art Challenge, which really was a part of that. Hence the birth of Art House, a Social Kitchen. It's truly a place for culture, art, food, and we even say fun, for the community to come together. It's a gathering place. It's a place where you can taste different kind of foods that may be happening with different vendors in the community. It really is a place to showcase art and of various forms that could be happening in the community. And so it really is this incredible idea of food, art, coming together and using a space to create kind of public art pieces that are displayed not only on the outside of the building, but on the inside of the building.
Now, the building itself is very impressive, especially at night with the lighting that's set up out there. I have not seen it personally, but I have seen photos of what it looks like at night. And when you go to our website, when you check out Regionally Speaking podcast later, you'll see a picture, the daytime picture, unfortunately, of what the Art House looks like. The nighttime picture is just as impressive, if not more so, because it's a building that will capture the imagination. You can think all kinds of things about that building just by driving by at night when the lights are all on. The idea for the building itself is obviously it's a combination of services. It's the art gallery, it's the culinary incubator, which is something that's very important in its own right. And you say that's kind of been able to help grow over the last couple of years or so. And then this community meeting space. It's in an unusual spot, at least for any other meeting space other than sports events. And the reason I say that is because it's right across the street on 5th Street from the U.S. Steel Yard, which is, of course, where the Railcats play baseball. So you see this big baseball stadium on one side and see this little very flashy-looking building, almost like made out of aluminum foil, on the other side of the street. When the designs were put together to create this building, did they have that in mind to have some facility that would contrast with the brickiness and the starkness of the baseball stadium?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was this idea of there are tons of people that are coming to Railcat Stadium, participating in games and enjoying their time there. What else can we continue to keep to attract and keep them there? And so when I first started with the program, you would see people come to the baseball games and they would walk on by. Now when they come to the games, they actually stop, they look, they're taking pictures. And again, it's that infusion of this public art piece, these lanterns. They're solar lanterns. They light up when the sun is shining really bright, and in the evening time, they'll light up at nighttime. They really create such a twinkle and a sparkle to, I think, the downtown area, and it just draws people's attention into what the space is.
Arlene, take us through the components of the entire project, starting out first with the culinary program, since we seem to know it first, and it's become predominantly that of this culinary incubator, which is only a very small part of this entire culinary program. Tell us about that.
Oh, so what they wanted to do, the Culinary Business Incubator Program, is really designed to work with individuals who have that culinary artistic ability to be able to cook food. They may have a really great product that maybe they've been cooking out of their home, but really want to expand and grow their product development. So the Culinary Business Incubator Program, which our first class, which was in March of this year, we had 24 participants who came, you know, on Saturdays, 4 hours worth of classroom training and instruction. We're supported by Food Hero Program, Arts and Public Life with the University of Chicago, just learning about what does it take to take what may be my idea around culinary art and actually really hone in the business aspects of it. They use business model canvassing as a kind of core component to the training to really kind of teach people, you know, how can you take that business plan, which may be this written document, but really to visualize how did that affect your customers? How did it affect the products that you have? So we had 24 absolutely incredible individuals who came out and have really kind of grown and developed in terms of their business abilities. Prime example would be California Jones, a group, individual, husband and wife team, have a catering business. They came in, took the Culinary Business Incubator class. We then were able to partner with them and a local youth program, City Life Center there in Gary, Indiana. And during the summer, we're able to provide breakfast and lunch, hot breakfast and hot lunches every day during the summer time for these individuals. So this allowed California Jones, which is a new business really starting out, to be able to come in and utilize this full commercial kitchen, which there's over 3,000 square feet of commercial kitchen space available for a culinary artist to come in and be able to kind of, again, work on the product and help them to mass produce the product that they're working with. And to be able to see that in action is truly, I think, the power of what Art House has to available to a budding culinary entrepreneur.
Are they finding, and did they find when they went through their courses set up there at the Culinary Incubator, that there's quite a difference between having a great idea and then crafting a business plan so you can turn that great idea into a business and then actually following through and getting to work with actual equipment? Or maybe before you might have just kind of tinkered around in the kitchen with an idea and you've got to push it that next extra step to make it actually an idea that is saleable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it really it helps them to really think about the type of products. You know, maybe they had a menu that had 10 items on it. No, we're going to actually change it to 5 because they've really figured out how to maybe mass produce or take those 5 items and really make them their signature products. And so that's been one of the great things about seeing the evolution of coming in, taking classes, but now you're really honing on your business, honing on your customers, and being able to really identify how can I make myself unique. And then eventually, the goal is always that they start in that culinary kitchen there at Art House, and eventually maybe they get a food truck, and then maybe eventually they get a brick and mortar. Again, being able to establish some of that economic development that's needed there in the city.
Now tell us, Arlene, where the social kitchen fits into all of this. Now, we've talked about the culinary incubator, so we get people that are interested in taking an idea for a great culinary idea and turning it into an actual business, or seeing certainly through the process whether it's going to work or not. Where does the social kitchen fit into things now?
It comes in as now we have a place for people to gather, and when we can gather around food, that makes it even better. And so we have programs in our culinary and arts exploration program. These are programs that are culinary based or they could be art based, and we host them there at Art House free of charge, invite the entire public to come out and participate in those programs, and it really becomes this social place where folks can come and gather, talk, meet, and greet. So we've had programs from a senior seasons blues show where we had a blues show just for senior citizens in the community. We had a cupcake wars where it was about families coming out and battling and tasting different kind of cupcakes that we've had. We've had a meal prep series where we had a young woman with Enjoy Eats come in and really talk about how do you help families to prepare healthy meals in the busy times that we have. We've had J-Rock's Gourmet Popcorn, a 12-year-old entrepreneur, coming in and talking about what does it take for me as a 12-year-old to create a business around food and being able to teach that skill to other people in the community. So we've had more than 60 different culinary and art exploration programs since November of last year that have been there at the Art House in our social kitchen area.
Wow.
And we've had more than 1,000 individuals that have come into the building and participated in one of those programs. So that right there is that catalyst of what Art House is in terms of bringing culture, art, and food and people to gather socially and to get to know who your neighbors are and what's happening in the community.
When the idea of Art House was created, obviously you've got the kitchen idea, which was something that was very important because the city of Gary had the opportunity to, I think, here to turn something into a good opportunity to create businesses, which the city needs and still always will need, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But then you've got this art gallery concept too. There aren't many ideas that kind of blossom into putting food and art together into one facility here. What kind of response have you gotten with just the art gallery alone now?
With just the art gallery, I think we are really exploring a lot more opportunities around the art. There are tons of people who have photographs of the city of Gary and its heyday. There are visual artists who are out there, young people who are artists in the local schools. We're really trying to bring those folks into the fold to really start to showcase them. And probably one of our up-and-coming events that we're having is our Gospel Mosaic, where we're going to bring in local artists to come in and do some painting. And during that time of painting, we'll also bring in artists to perform gospel music, but a variety, from a quartet to a choir to an individual, but to really be able to feature a variety of different folks. Again, it's that bringing together of all these kind of different kind of people and individuals and displays of art, but having a place and a venue for that to happen there in the city of Gary.
In the last 2.5 years since Theaster Gates' vision for Art House blossomed into the request to create the application for the grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, that in turn, of course, led to receiving the first City of Gary City's Challenges grant. What kind of recognition or at least interest have you gotten from outside Gary about this particular project? And that I understand that some of that interest comes not only in other communities interested in it, but also the media, too.
I definitely think we've had some interest out of Indianapolis with Centric Innovations doing some business workshops there we have at Art House. We've worked very wonderfully with Work One, the City of Gary, and employment opportunities. Currently, right now at Art House, we have an incredible retail fundamentals class that's happening with individuals in the community to teach them about the retail trade and get training and certification in that particular area. A lot of interest from just across the board, Chicago, all over the place, that want to come in and be able to provide additional workshops or supports to really help the community to grow.
And I understand one of the most recent articles that's come out online, and I guess it's in a trade magazine. It's called Curbed. It's a magazine that's put out for urban planners, and mm-hmm. It's a national magazine. But the idea is that they like to look at different projects all across the country. The City of Gary was prominently displayed in one of the recent online articles, not only about the City of Gary's problems and how they've come through working them out, but also, too, talking about Art House. How does Art House fit into all of this from Curb's standpoint?
I think with Art House, we are one of those catalysts in terms of when you're thinking about planning for a city or planning for development in a city, you have to think about public art and think about it in a different kind of way as a draw to bring people into the community. You have to think about culinary arts and how are you going to, you know, when people come, they want to be able to eat. And so how are you going to make sure that you have a variety of places and venues and food options for folks that want to come into your community. And I really think Art House has just been one of those catalysts. There are probably at least 3 new restaurants in the city of Gary that are now very popular and people know that they can come and participate in those places there. So it's been amazing to just see this new venue and this new space really blossom, and we're just one part of all the things that can and should be happening in the city of Gary.
Now, if anybody would like to know more about Art House, what's the website address so people can check it out and find out more about, especially if they want to be involved in either the Culinary Incubator or some of the other programs?
It is arthousegary.com. Again, arthousegary.com.
Arlene Peterson, the manager of Art House, a social kitchen in Gary. Indiana Landmarks has a new Northwest Indiana Region Director. I met with Brad Miller in his office in Gary's Miller neighborhood recently and asked him to introduce himself, tell us what he's already found interesting about the region, and what lies ahead for local preservation efforts.
Came to the Northwest Field Office of Indiana Landmarks just last month, really, as a full-time position here. I'm coming from our South Bend office, which is our northern regional headquarters. And I was with Landmarks a previous year before that, as of two Junes ago. And really, my background is in history and historic preservation. I studied history in college, and then I went on to study historic preservation in graduate school, and focused a lot on the importance of the built environment that we have and how that connects us to our past. And one thing I felt important for that was, if we don't have these places to connect with, then it's pretty difficult. So that's where I really leaned into the preservation side and looking to preserve the buildings that act as these kind of catalysts for stories and the shared heritage that we have today.
Now, you come over into this position from working on staff with the Indiana Landmarks Northern Indiana office, which is based out of South Bend. Have you noticed, and from that you came in from another state, and from your experiences there, did you find things interesting when you switched from other states coming into Indiana, and in turn, what you picked up working there in the northern part of the state that you like that kind of are similar, or you find that Northwest Indiana is very much challenging and very much more different to look into?
Well, yeah, certainly. Previously to coming to Landmarks, I was in Boston for a year, so very urban, metropolitan area. And before that, I was in Tennessee, so a very rural area. So I had a wide span of experience through that nature. And then coming to the Northern Regional Office kind of has both the best worlds. You have South Bend, which is a pretty large city center. But the rest of Northern Indiana is very, you know, flat and rural and agricultural. And so those all pose different challenges for preservation. So coming over to Northwest Indiana, it's very much the same makeup. Obviously, the northern parts of Lake and Porter County are more dense and more urban versus the more agricultural and rural settings in the southern, in Jasper and Newton, and also southern Lake and Porter counties. So they certainly pose the same kind of challenge that I faced in the north, which is, you know, smaller communities have a different makeup compared to more city centers. So the building stock's completely different. It's more dense. There's different challenges with site development because of the industry that used to be here versus, you know, the little natural impacts that happen more in the south part of this region. So kind of just tackling those one at a time and thinking about how buildings can become, you know, one part of the shared story that we're able to tell, but two, the economic development of the region through repurposing these buildings.
When you came over here and you said you were working in the area around South Bend, Elkhart, those communities there, and then there are a lot of smaller communities in that particular area too, like Bristol and those other small towns that kind of fit in, and they all have different ways that they've developed over the decades and centuries in some cases too. And so you find that the preservation aspects in those types of communities are different, but do they fit in from what you've seen so far, that variety of development here in Northwest Indiana, aside from the big industrial sites that are there?
Well, yes, certainly. And as we all know, Northwest Indiana was settled at a much later time because it was not, the swamps were not drained until much later in the history of Indiana. So the building stock is a lot later. We're also fortunate to have a great selection of mid-century modern architecture in Northwest Indiana, which kind of poses a different question. People don't really see it as historic yet because a lot of people grew up in these homes. So that's kind of an interesting thing that preservationists are facing across the country and then obviously here in Northwest Indiana. But yeah, I think the building stock is very much similar in Indiana. No matter where you go, you pick up these kind of cool varieties. particularly because of the industry, there was a lot of workers' housing that was put together, so more compact housing, more utilitarian, and kind of how people tackle those issues in housing workers back, 100 years ago is very interesting and cool stories to tell today.
Brad Miller, the new Northwest Regional Office Director of Indiana Landmarks. On this Monday, here's John Kane with Eye on the Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Greg Hertzlieb, the director of the Brower Museum of Art at Valparaiso University. And welcome, Greg.
Thank you so much, Jen.
So you have all of those magnificent holdings at the Brower Museum of Art of all sorts, really. But you do have a really amazing selection of Frank Dudley paintings.
That's right, and it just grows all the time, and we're really grateful for it, and we learn more about the artist every time we see a new painting by him.
Well, we had our exhibit that we did together last year and right. earlier this year, last summer and earlier in 2017. Very popular exhibit.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun to work on. Learned a ton. I think everybody did.
And several Dudleys were featured in that
exhibit. Oh, sure. Absolutely.
But this is all Dudley.
Right. Now, the interesting thing is with the South Shore show, that was a lot of our permanent collection. In this show, currently, we have 52 paintings on display, but only four of them are from the Brower's collection. Many others from a lot of different lenders all across
really?
The U.S. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. So you you had to reach out to collectors.
Right.
And
exactly right. Now, the author of the accompanying publication, Jim Dabbert, in addition to being a Dudley scholar, is also a collector mm-hmm. and so has quite a few historically important, biographically important, I guess I should say, paintings by Dudley that are included in the show, give an idea of his early style, his early years. And then we have other Midwest collections represented, both public and private.
Mm-hmm.
We have some local lenders, which is a treat. The Valparaiso Women's Association has theirs on display,
mm-hmm.
Freshly cleaned. The Porter County History Museum has theirs on display, also freshly cleaned. And the paintings look great after that conservation restoration.
Yeah.
They really come to life. They look fresh as the day they were painted.
Exactly. The old varnish is removed.
Right. Exactly right. And there's a grime that accumulates over the years that darkens a painting.
Uh-huh. Right.
A cleaning brings it back to its brightness.
Yeah. You see that sometimes when flash photography is used in photographing an old painting. I've noticed that underneath it sees through the varnish somehow.
That's really interesting.
Have you never experienced that?
Just in a book.
And a book.
It just had seen, kind of a reproduction.
Yeah. Sometime years ago, somebody left us at the Art Center. They left us a painting, early 20th century landscape, Brown County type landscape. And it was quite beautiful. And it had been hanging on one of the office walls for some time. And a Chicago dealer was offered to sell it for us, and he took a picture of it, and it was just magnificent, the color that you could see through.
That's really neat.
Yeah, so obviously he had it cleaned. Where did the Women's Association and where did those groups have their...
Yeah, now both of those were at Baumgartner's on Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and he's done a lot of Dudleys over the years, and... has a kind of a feel for him after
right.
a while,
yeah.
How the artist painted and how he prepared his canvases, these kinds of things.
John Kane talking with Greg Hertzlieb with the Brower Museum of Art at Valparaiso University about the Frank Dudley display. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. Join us tomorrow for Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer.